Welcome to the Singular Links podcast. This is Tony Parrish, a.k.a. Slinker. This episode features Chapter 8 of the audiobook Singular Links. The episode explores different finds for different minds and examines how our unique life experiences and memories act as filters for discovery. We'll discuss how noticing is a personal act of invention. What you notice impacts your understanding of the world around you, and the connections you make are the ones that resonate specifically with the way you are wired to see. I hope you enjoy Different Finds for Different Minds. Different Finds for Different Minds. In this chapter, we'll explore how different minds notice, connect, and interpret the world, how those differences shape the discoveries you're capable of making, and how you can cultivate attention to increase insights. This section is about creating a mindset for innovation, a mental framework, a way of seeing, a curiosity that invites discovery. The key word is curiosity. So much of discovery stems from a curiosity about how things work, how they fit together, and how they interact. What happens if you try this? Can these properties that you see in this area also apply in other areas? Creativity at its heart is curiosity. It's the impulse to explore patterns, connections, and possibilities. It's a kind of playfulness and improvisation. It is exploration without a fully formed map, a willingness to step into the unknown and feel your way forward. It requires a mindset that's comfortable with some amount of uncertainty, that accepts the awkwardness inherent in discovery. Every inventor, entrepreneur, and innovator experiences this. No idea springs fully formed. Every insight needs refinement. But alongside that common struggle is what you alone contribute. A perspective no one else can have. A way of seeing the world that is entirely yours. Curiosity is the essential link that connects initial observations to breakthroughs. Claude Shannon embodied it by asking, what's a better way to get information, from his childhood telegraph experiments to his challenge of the differential analyzer? Chuck Close was driven by the singular ambition, I just want to paint again, forcing him to ask, what could I accomplish with my paralysis? Jeffrey West exhibited it by extending his biological observations, wondering, why are these specific fractions so prevalent across the living world? And then, could they exist in man-made systems as well? And Bruce Lee, confined to his bed with a spinal injury, turned his potential career-ending setback into a period of deep inquiry, asking, how does a good fighter, even a great fighter, become the embodiment of decisive action? Ultimately leading to a refraction of combat philosophy itself. Throughout this book, I mostly avoid saying things like, you need to do this or you need to do that. Whenever an author tells me what I need to do, I roll my eyes. How do they know what I need? They don't even know me. It always sounds a little self-important, like someone pretending to give universal advice when they're really just talking to themselves. But every now and then, rules deserve to be broken, so I'm going to say it. Innovators need to be curious. And innovators need to get a little uncomfortable. Curiosity is the fuel that moves everything forward. It's what makes you stop in the middle of the street because you noticed something unusual. Most people see it and just keep walking, but the curious ones stop and look closer. Curiosity is what makes you ask, what if I tried this another way? It's also what gets you into trouble sometimes, and that's fine. The old line about curiosity killed the cat probably came from someone who didn't want the cat poking around where it wasn't supposed to. But it's okay to be the cat who pokes around. Go ahead, poke around. Don't stay in line. Turn over rocks to see what's crawling underneath. And with curiosity comes discomfort. That's how you know you're stretching. There's a saying that you should do one thing every day that makes you uncomfortable. I like that. But not because struggle is noble or pain builds character. It's because discomfort means you're growing, like a lobster pushing open its old shell. Discomfort is caused by learning something your old habits can't handle yet. Sometimes you push against a wall, and the wall moves. Sometimes it doesn't. Either way, you learn something about where your limits are. Of course, sometimes you push hard and keep pushing, and eventually you come to realize you've reached a dead end. That's a different kind of discomfort, the kind that comes from trying and failing. Every ambitious person knows it, and that's a realization that can hurt. But it's better than the paralysis that comes from staying inert. At least failure gives you information. It shows you the edges of what's possible. You can work with that. Uncertainty is the innovator's playground. It's not always fun, but it's where the interesting stuff lives. When you already know the outcome, there's nothing left to discover. It's like watching a movie where you can predict the ending in the first 10 minutes. You stop caring. The surprise, the tension, the "I didn't see that coming." That's what keeps you engaged. That's what creativity feels like. It's unpredictable and messy and often uncomfortable, but that's what makes it alive. The goal isn't to be comfortable with discomfort. That's not realistic. Nobody enjoys sleeping on a cold cement floor just to prove a point. The goal is to stay open long enough to learn from uncertainty instead of running from it. Innovation grows in that space between what you know and what you can't quite see yet. It's like opening a door without knowing what's on the other side. Maybe the room on the other side is just an empty gray box. Or maybe it's a room full of fascinating people you're meant to meet. You open the door in either case, because if you don't open the door, you'll never know what's behind it. Curiosity makes you reach for the handle. Tolerance for uncertainty lets you walk through. People mix up the words fall and fail all the time. They're spelled almost the same, and people often use those two words interchangeably, failing and falling. But they're not the same. Falling only becomes failing if you don't get up again. If you fall and stand back up, you're not failing. You're learning. You're improving. When you fall and get back up, you're doing something that is approaching the exact opposite of failing. In a way, falling down is part of the work. It's rehearsal for getting better. That's why curiosity and discomfort are essential. One gets you moving, the other keeps you honest. There's a term in Zen practice called beginner's mind. It means approaching everything as if it's brand new, without the weight of your past successes or the fear of repeating old mistakes. It's a reminder to stay open, especially when you think you already know. That's how you stay inventive. So yes, I believe innovators do need to be curious and need to accept some level of discomfort. Those open the doors to everything else. Mind the gap. Because no two brains are alike, some people naturally excel at making certain kinds of connections more than others. Enter Howard Gardner, developmental psychologist and theorist of multiple intelligences. Gardner proposed that people don't process the world in a one-size-fits-all way. Different people bring different strengths, different filters, different ways of understanding. Diverse minds, diverse intelligences. Gardner identified 8 types of minds: linguistic, logical-mathematical, musical, spatial, bodily-kinesthetic, interpersonal, intrapersonal, and naturalistic. Importantly, he cautioned that these intelligences are not learning styles or personality types, but rather distinct ways of processing information and solving problems. If you think about the people in your life, you'll likely see some of these traits in the ways they behave. One person is fluent in numbers. Another is a born athlete. Someone has an uncanny sense of direction. Another can turn a spoon and a rubber band into a percussion instrument. Brains don't all approach the world the same way, or interpret it the same way, or even care about the same things. What feels like quantum physics to one person is elementary school math to someone else, and vice versa. Your own mind likely contains all of these intelligences to varying degrees. it can help to imagine each intelligence on a scale of 0 to 10. Maybe you'd score a 7 in spatial intelligence, a 9 in linguistic intelligence, and a solid 2 in musical intelligence. Sorry to dash your ambitions for Carnegie Hall. These categories aren't mutually exclusive or arranged in some fixed hierarchy. They're more like adjustable dials, with each acting independent of the others. Bruce Lee exemplified bodily kinesthetic intelligence at an extreme level. He could sense the movement of his own body and others' bodies in precise, highly nuanced ways, translating that awareness into martial skill. Gardner's framework may go a long way toward explaining why your gym teacher brother, an 8 in bodily kinesthetic intelligence and maybe a 6 in interpersonal intelligence, might always seem to lock horns with your more analytical, detail-obsessed uncle. Their mental wiring doesn't overlap much. Cue the tension at Thanksgiving dinner and attribute that tension simply to neurodiversity. Now let's bring this back to connection making. Different minds make different kinds of links. A person who scores high in linguistic intelligence might riff on puns, poems, or political speeches with ease. A spatial thinker might see patterns in blueprints or build imaginary cities in their head. Someone with strong interpersonal intelligence might walk into a room and instantly sense the emotional temperature. High intrapersonal intelligence means having a finely tuned radar for your own thoughts, feelings, and motivations. And here's where it gets even more interesting. These intelligences don't just exist separately. They interact. They amplify each other. An architect with strong spatial and interpersonal intelligence might intuit how a public space invites movement, for instance. An artist who scores high in linguistic and musical intelligence might become an amazing lyricist. Gardner isn't the only one offering maps of the mind. Temple Grandin, renowned scientist, animal behavior expert, and the subject of an Emmy-winning biopic, categorizes thinkers into 3 types: visual, pattern, and verbal. Among visual thinkers, she further distinguishes between those who think in detailed images of objects and those who think in spatial relationships. Object visualizers are the people who remember every detail. If you take 2 people to the same place, the object visualizer will notice the wallpaper pattern, the ceiling height, the exact shade of the exit sign, while the other person may only notice that the coffee is bitter. Spatial visualizers, on the other hand, think in systems. They intuit how parts relate, how sequences work, how a mechanism functions. They're the ones who pull apart a broken appliance and somehow get it working again. Claude Shannon was a great spatial visualizer. Bruce Lee also demonstrated high spatial intelligence. He intuitively understood how forces, trajectories, and timing worked in 3-dimensional space. Chuck Close was a perfect illustration of the object visualizer that Temple Grandin describes. Close could recall minute details of faces, textures, and patterns, which he translated into massive, hyper-detailed portraits. His mind showed how meticulous attention to discrete details could create insights and output that others with the same spatial intelligence but weaker object visualization might not achieve. Jeffrey West saw cities, organisms, and organizations as networks with patterns that scale across magnitudes. He represents the spatial visualizer, who thinks in systems rather than isolated objects, someone who connects parts to whole, understanding flows, feedback loops, and emergent behaviors. As with Gardner, Grandin's model recognizes a spectrum. Most of us aren't all in on one type. Most of us are composites. But occasionally, someone comes along with a mind that's radically tilted toward one area. Take Derek Paravicini, the blind British pianist who can replicate entire orchestral pieces after hearing them just once. I'm not talking about playing melodies. Paravicini can hear a complex musical arrangement and then play every part of every instrument's contribution to that arrangement. It's extraordinary. Yet despite his musical gifts, including perfect pitch and exceptional recall, he struggles profoundly with language and communication. His genius is focused, not general. The links you make will be shaped by the way your mind sees, hears, touches, and organizes the world. Your brain might light up around sound, or logic, or relationships, or movement. There's no single path to meaningful connection, just different finds for different minds. 1% inspiration. Genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. That quote from Thomas Edison emphasizes the importance of dedication, of commitment, of stick-to-itiveness. Those are fine qualities for innovators to possess. But the really interesting question is, where does that 1% come from? What is the source of the idea? What triggers the epiphany? What are the ingredients of insight? Where does creativity originate? In ancient Greece, Archimedes shouted, "Eureka!" when his bathwater overflowed and he made the connection between the volume of displaced water and the purity of the king's crown. The discovery came from his bathing routine. Google founder Larry Page dreamt he could download the entire internet and, waking from his dream, he set out to build a search engine to do just that. The connection came from a dream. When Einstein was stuck on a particularly thorny math problem, he would sit down to play the violin. In the process of focusing on pitch and bowing technique, emphatically not focusing on the math problem, the solution would form in his mind. The insight emerged when the active part of his brain became inactive and relaxed. Each of these stories involves an individual who encountered an orthogonal influence. Orthogonal means something that intersects at a right angle, or is unrelated, or comes straight out of left field. It is a novel influence which, when linked to something else, can create a discovery. The link is the leap. You and I don't see the world the same way, and that's what makes things interesting. Your perspective, like mine, is shaped by a mix of everything you've lived and learned. Family, culture, education, media, values. These are filters that shape what you notice, what you trust, what you question. And over time, those filters form patterns. You and I probably gravitate toward the people who share the same kinds of views as ours. Think of it as a form of perspective clustering. That's why people who don't share your perspective can sometimes seem to be speaking a different language, because, in a way, they are. They use different mental references to construct their worldview, like a Venn diagram where the circles have very little overlap. Often, creative breakthroughs emerge when different mental modes intersect, when you shift between the specific and the general, the tangible and the conceptual, the sensory and the structural. It's not A or B, it's A and B. Left brain and right brain. Orthogonal connections. Linking different perspectives can harvest the inherent tension between them. F. Scott Fitzgerald said, "The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function." Storytelling and statistics are not opposites to reconcile, but tools that can be used jointly, like a bow and arrow, or computer software and computer hardware. Innovation often doesn't come from choosing a unique lens, so much as it comes from switching lenses, combining lenses, and using one perspective to refocus the other. Think of transformation by reduction, expansion, extension, and refraction. This ability to move between modes, to toggle, to translate, is what sets creative thinkers apart. Good fiction displays this dichotomy. A movie plot often begins with a jolt, something that grips the senses, and then goes on to explore the answers to deeper questions. Jaws is an iconic example. It starts with a terrifying shark attack, before shifting pace to focus on Chief Brody's pragmatic quest to make the beach safe again. Citizen Kane opens with intrigue, a single cryptic word, Rosebud, and then unpacks an inquiry into memory, ambition, and loss. Emotion leads, then meaning follows. Blockbusters like Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings cast their spell with wizards and creatures, then ask the spellbound audience to consider deeper questions. What does it mean to stand up for what's right? How do you carry responsibility when its weight seems unbearable? These separate considerations complement each other to craft epic stories. Daniel Kahneman, in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, named the dual processes of thinking System 1 and System 2. System 1 is fast, instinctive, responsive thinking. System 2 is slower and more analytical thinking. System 1 delivers a snap judgment from brief exposure to scant details. It helped early humans react quickly before some mortal danger removed them from the gene pool. But the System 1 thinker also leaps to conclusions, often without basis, and makes ill-considered judgments. In the words of Sherlock Holmes, it is a capital mistake to theorize before one has data. That's the drawback of System 1 thinking. Think of the fear that gripped beachgoers after the theatrical release of the movie Jaws. Shark attacks have always been statistically rare, but for the broader population, the threat became vivid and exaggerated, causing beach tourism to plummet. Or after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, in response to a perceived threat of hijackers, a large population decided it would be safer to cancel their flights and drive to their destinations, which resulted in a spike in road fatalities. In each of these examples, the collective mind overcorrected to what was essentially a minuscule risk. That is the pitfall of System 1. By contrast, Kahneman's System 2 thinking is slower and more reflective. It compares, analyzes, tests. It builds arguments and identifies inconsistencies. It's a great way of thinking when careful analysis is needed. But the Achilles heel of System 2 is that it can stall under pressure, paralysis by analysis, like the quarterback overthinking the play and getting sacked, or the hungry customer staring at a 30-page diner menu, indecisive with too many options. The point is, we need both System 1 and System 2. The real skill lies in knowing when to trust instinct and when to question it. In tennis, a champion may have perfect mechanics, drilled through years of repetition. But when the rally stretches into chaos, it's the competitor's grit and improvisation that win the point. Get the ball over the net. One more shot. Scramble. Stretch. Trust. Repetition sets the floor. Responsiveness carries the match. Psychologists call this athletic activity being in a flow state. It's a deep immersion where action and awareness fuse, and effort feels effortless. This is the performer's version of innovation. In his research on expertise, Swedish psychologist Anders Ericsson emphasized that mastery isn't just about repetition. It depends on deliberate practice, which is focused, goal-driven, and mentally demanding. Malcolm Gladwell later popularized this idea as the 10,000-hour rule in his book, Outliers. Done right, this kind of intentional effort rewires the mind, builds a strong technical foundation, and eventually makes performance feel fluid and intuitive, even playful. That's what leads to the innovator's shift. The moment when rules dissolve, not because you forget them, but because you've absorbed them so completely that they no longer need managing. The jazz musician stops thinking in scales. The actor ditches the script and loses herself in the role. The martial artist reacts without analysis. Structure becomes instinct. Charlie Parker said, "Master your instrument, master the music, and then forget all that, and just play." The expression in martial arts is, "Learn the form, master the form, forget the form." Bruce Lee captured this idea in the Tao of Jeet Kune Do. When one has reached maturity in the art, one will have a formless form, he said. When one has no form, one can be all forms. To some, this may just sound baffling, but the point is, deep familiarity frees the possibility for true innovation. Lee saw the learning process unfolding in distinct phases. It starts with the primitive phase, where movement is raw and driven purely by instinct. That's nature. The learner then moves to the art phase, a period dedicated to understanding and mastering specific techniques through deliberate effort. That's nurture. The journey culminates in artlessness, where combined techniques become so deeply ingrained that they transform into a natural, effortless intuition, allowing for a deeper and more unconstrained expression. Lee joked, "Before I studied the art, a punch was just a punch. After I'd studied the art, a punch was no longer a punch. Now, a punch is just a punch." Cognitive psychology describes a similar journey to mastery in four stages. There's unconscious incompetence, you don't know what you're missing. Conscious incompetence, you realize what you're missing. Conscious competence, you can perform, but it takes effort. And finally, unconscious competence. You can flow without having to think about what you're doing while you're doing it. Society tends to reward hyper-specialization. The most lucrative occupations tend to encourage a deep, narrow focus in a specific niche. But that kind of tunnel vision can obscure the broader context. Thinking broadly and seeing the big picture have their benefits. At the same time, sweeping theories that ignore practical realities tend to fall apart. If you zoom in too far, you lose sight of the big picture. If you zoom out too far, the details lose meaning. Real insight comes from shifting between both views, micro and macro. Each one clarifies the other. Mastery is the ability to incorporate different perspectives, to toggle as needed. Breakthroughs happen when you combine structure and freedom, form and feeling. Separately, they're incomplete. Together, they create emergence. Linking different perspectives is what creates the leap. The missing link. Let's rewind the tape 3 million years to meet Lucy, a quick-footed, tree-loving hominid just trying to make it through another day on the African savanna. Her buddy, meanwhile, is having what scientists might call a statistically unlucky day. The bugs he ate for breakfast are staging a full-blown riot in his gut. He's wincing from stepping on something sharp, possibly the prehistoric equivalent of a Lego brick. And just as he's contemplating how much worse things can get, cue the saber-toothed tiger. One surprise pounce later, and Lucy's buddy has had his arm ripped off. As for Lucy, she saw a suspicious shadow, muttered something in early hominid for nope, and sprinted away before waiting to investigate. She lived. Her buddy, on the other hand, he became a cautionary tale. Lucy survived because she made a quick mental link. A moving shadow might mean danger. That one cognitive leap kept her alive. Her brain didn't need to be certain. It just needed to make a connection fast enough. She used what Daniel Kahneman called System 1 thinking. Pattern recognition is hardwired into the human brain, and it has been keeping sharp for millions of years. The better you are at spotting patterns, the better your odds of survival. Doctors use patterns to make diagnoses. Data analysts sift through noise to find meaning. Investors chase trends. Detectives piece together motives and events. Marketers analyze their customers' habits. In nearly every field, pattern recognition is the foundation for insight and decision-making. And it starts in the visual cortex. When you read, your visual cortex is working to convert the words into concepts and into meaning. Your brain is drawing connections, linking phrases, forming an understanding one word at a time. Even when you dream, your visual cortex stays active. That's why dreams can be so wildly vivid. Your brain never really stops trying to make sense of what it sees. It's comforting to spot patterns. They tame chaos. they frame the formlessness. They make the strange feel familiar. Your brain is so committed to this task, in fact, it even finds patterns where none exist. That's called pareidolia, the psychological phenomenon in which the mind perceives familiar patterns, shapes, or objects in random or ambiguous stimuli, even when no actual pattern exists. Pareidolia is seeing faces in clouds or seeing the face of Jesus on a piece of toast. One woman saw the Virgin Mary on her grilled cheese and sold it for $28,000. True story. Pareidolia is the brain saying, "I got this," even when the data points are murky. It fills in gaps. It completes the image. Sometimes that's helpful. Other times, it leads us off the rails, as in the formation of conspiracy theories. Consider the famous Lincoln-Kennedy coincidences. 7 letters in each name, both elected to Congress in 46 and to the presidency in 60. Assassins with 3 names, the odd theater warehouse swap, vice presidents named Johnson, and so on. The similarities feel eerie, but many of these claims are just plain wrong. Lincoln's secretary wasn't named Kennedy. Booth was caught in a barn, not a warehouse. And some dates don't line up at all. Even the coincidences that are true aren't particularly surprising. With thousands of facts, a few matches are inevitable. A vivid example is the birthday paradox, which shows that in a group of 23 people, there is roughly a 50% chance that at least 2 people will share a birthday. Go ahead and Google it. The point isn't the specifics, but how your brain responds. Your brain doesn't just spot patterns, it yearns for them. Your brain fills in gaps, smooths the rough edges, and builds meaning from fragments. Sometimes that's clever. Sometimes it's dangerous. A medical misdiagnosis, a wrongful conviction, a faulty conclusion based on too little evidence. These misidentified patterns can be fatal. But in other moments, that same pattern-seeking instinct leads to creativity, curiosity, and wonder. Artists find beauty in chaos. Scientists find signals in noise. You notice a flicker in the shadows and, like Lucy, decide to run. Recognizing the connection might just be the thing that keeps you alive. Never lose sight of visitor eyes. I remember my first visit to New York City. I walked into a deli one morning, looking to grab breakfast, and immediately found myself in a chaos of voices, clattering pans, and people darting around like ants in a tree stump. Someone behind the counter barked, "Who's next?" and 2 or 3 customers shouted their orders at once. The guy picked the loudest one, yelled it back, spun around, and got to work. Meanwhile, more people walked in behind me, shouted their orders, and somehow got served before I did. To be a seasoned New Yorker, this was just breakfast. To me, seeing it for the first time, it felt primal, wild, barely controlled. But after a couple of days, I found myself walking into the same deli and shouting, "Egg and cheese on a roll," like I'd lived there my entire life. When you first visit a place, you see it with visitor eyes. Everything is unfamiliar, and your senses are tuned to pick up every detail. Street signs are a different color than you're used to seeing, written in an unfamiliar font. People dress differently. The cars look odd. Even the smells in the air, food, rain, exhaust, are subtly foreign. Your brain is hungry, devouring new information, trying to make sense of the unfamiliar. But something shifts once a place becomes familiar. The blur of details that once captivated you starts to fade into the background. The street signs and cars and outfits are still there, but now they just confirm what you already know about the place. They're no longer building your impression, they're just reinforcing it. When you visit a place for the first time, it's like working on a jigsaw puzzle without knowing what the picture is. In the beginning, every detail is exciting, because each one reveals something new. Some pieces are transformative, and they suddenly help you understand what the whole picture might be. But once the puzzle is finished, the individual pieces stop being special. They've served their purpose. They're just part of the whole. The only time a puzzle piece becomes valuable again is when it goes missing. That's when you notice it. That's when it matters. Consider something very specific. A complete set of 1952 Topps baseball cards. There are 408 cards in total. If you somehow had the full set, you'd be holding something worth millions. But remove just one card, even a minor one, and the value drops. Remove a major card, like the Mickey Mantle rookie card number 311, and the value nosedives. Sometimes the absence of something makes it valuable. That's just basic supply and demand, but that's not really the point I want to make. The point is about visitor eyes, that unusual and fleeting way of seeing the world around you when everything is new and nothing has yet settled into the background. The moment you stop seeing with visitor eyes, things begin to slip into the realm of the ordinary. And this doesn't just apply to places. It applies to people, too. When you meet someone for the first time, their quirks stand out. You notice the unusual rhythm of their laugh, their oddly specific hobbies, the way they tilt their head when thinking. These details feel like clues to a larger mystery. They're intriguing. You find yourself wanting to understand the person behind the puzzle pieces. But over time, those same quirks become part of your established picture of them. They go from being sources of curiosity to things you just expect. Harry's crooked nose that once made you wonder what happened to his nose is now just a familiar part of his face. He's Harry, and he happens to have a crooked nose. One of the most valuable things you can do in life, in relationships, in creative work, is to see the familiar in unfamiliar ways. If you can find wonder in commonplace, everyday items, that is a rare quality. And people who can do that are worth paying attention to. Back in the 1990s, astronomers were debating how to use the Hubble Space Telescope. Some wanted to point it toward one of the dark, unremarkable patches of sky, one of those seemingly empty spaces where nothing appeared to be happening. Others thought that would be a waste of time and resources. But when Hubble finally turned its lens toward a tiny dark spot, the result was astonishing. It contained thousands of previously unseen galaxies, each containing billions of stars. The patch of dark sky wasn't empty. It was full. Sometimes the blank space holds the biggest surprises, but only if you bother to look. So, don't lose sight of those visitor eyes. Keep them sharp. Keep them curious. They're how you see what others miss. They're how you see commonplace, everyday items in novel ways. The main message is that every mind is wired differently. And it's those differences that make you and me and each of us capable of unique discoveries. Some people excel at noticing patterns in numbers, others in movement, sound, or relationships. Some see systems as wholes, while others track every detail of individual elements. These variations, whether described through Gardner's multiple intelligences or other frameworks, shape how you make connections and uncover insights. The links you notice, the patterns you perceive, and the leaps of understanding you make are all filtered through the one-of-a-kind architecture of your brain. No one else sees the world exactly as you do. And it's this individuality that gives rise to original thought and creative breakthroughs. In the next chapter, we'll explore how to increase the volume and impact of the discoveries you make by paying attention to how you pay attention. Just as each mind notices and links information differently, each mind can also cultivate habits of observation that amplify insight. We'll look at practical ways to tune your awareness, sharpen your perception, and guide your curiosity so that you see more, connect more, and uncover more than you might otherwise. That's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to explore more ideas like this, you can find much, much more at singularlinks.com. If you're feeling frisky, tell your friends and family, in-laws and outlaws. Music was provided by the Slink Tones. Until next time, connect the unconnected, create the unexpected.